The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine, which is new, is dated November 7/November 14, 2022. It has the red border with the white inner border in large block letters, capitals all. Time is on the top of the front cover. It is superimposed upon gradations of light gray to medium, then darker gray to black at the bottom of the page. There is a large circle in the center. It's orange with pink continents and a green heart on the northern tip of Africa. That would be South America, because just off to the northwest lies America, the North American continent. So the small heart in green is superimposed upon the northern edge of the very pink South American continent, above which and slightly to the west is the North American continent, also in bright pink. The title is The Planet We Made. Stare at the green heart for 12 seconds, then turn the page and keep staring, which I have done, and where I then see a white heart. I don't know if that was the intent, but that's what I see, a white heart on a silver-gray background. And now for behind the cover, a short article entitled A Different Way to See Our Planet by D.W. Pine, Creative Director. Maybe this will tell me what I was supposed to see. Time has released more than 5,000 covers since our founding almost a century ago, but this is the first one where the viewer's eyes create the image. In the run-up to the COP27 climate conference, the UN meeting at which global leaders will negotiate the next steps toward managing that crisis, we sought a cover image that could speak to the intensity of the current climate situation. So we turned the cover, or rather covers, over to one of the world's most prominent contemporary artists, Olafur Eliasson. Eliasson, perhaps, E-L-I-A-S-S-O-N. Eliasson creates sculptures and large-scale installations that employ elemental materials, such as light, water, and air, to enhance the viewer's experience of the ordinary. To accomplish the effect on Time's cover, the Icelandic-Danish artist used a technique called after-imaging. Following the instructions on the page allows your eye to reimagine our overheated planet in the greens and blues that are the colors of a healthy Earth. After image is basically created within your own perceptual apparatus by your eyes and brain. That is, whenever you look at something, you don't generally see or notice them unless you look at something for a long time and then turn away to look at a blank surface, he says. Looking twice is what Eliasson's cover asks us all to do, and it is no coincidence that the visual anchor at the center of it all is a heart. This image is not actually there on the page, but inside you, he says. You create it. You make the world. He spoke to Time about the thinking behind the cover. Read more on time.com. Continuing with this article, here's a question. This seems to be a question-answer format of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 instances. Can you point to a singular moment when you discovered that you could tell the story of the climate and nature through your art? Answer, like many people of my generation, I grew up taking nature for granted as something unchanging. My interest in working with materials like light, color, water, fog, and other natural phenomena grew out of my desire to dematerialize the art object, to make things that were less physical than, say, ephemeral or atmospheric. In 2003, around the time I created the Weather Project, the artificial sun in the Tate Modern in London, I began thinking about the weather, about how it affects our lives and our moods and our experiences, and how we in turn affect it. From there, it was not a great leap to thinking about how we are affecting the planet as a whole through human-induced climate change. When Time declared the endangered Earth to be Person, or rather Planet of the Year for 1988, the cover featured a plastic-wrapped globe by the artist Christo. In the years since, despite a trove of urgent scientific facts, the issue has still struggled to gain global acceptance. Why do you think that is? Answer, there's a lot of evidence that fear-based communication about the dangers of climate change are not as effective as communicating concrete actions. But this is still the main way that the climate emergency is communicated in the media. I think the experiences of the pandemic and the struggles to enact comprehensive, science-based policies to combat the virus have taught us a lot about the limits and possibilities for enacting change to habits on a large scale. I do think that you need to give people a positive image of the future that they're working toward, a more equitable, sustainable world for all, both humans and non-humans alike. Question, I love that your work makes the viewer experience something, whether it is the sun inside the Tate Modern or huge chunks of glacial ice for Ice Watch. Can you talk about the importance you place on actually experiencing nature and the climate through your art? Answer, there is something extraordinary about the direct experience that art can offer at a moment when so many of us encounter the world via digital devices. Whether it's a live music performance, theater show, or art exhibition, there's something about being in one's body at a certain place and at a certain time, sharing an experience with others that cannot be replaced by our devices, as we learned during the pandemic. Especially when you think about something as large scale and seemingly distant as climate change. It is often precisely this experiential level that's missing in motivating action. Question, what would you like the reader to experience in the afterimage on this cover? Answer, it's my hope viewers take away from this idea of how much their own perception of the world contributes to making it. And if we can see the world anew, or even just our representations of the world, then we can think about it in a new way too, and I hope even change it. Question, what gives you hope for the future of our planet and the climate? Answer, I have the feeling the young people today are thinking very much from a standpoint of the future, unlike my generation, which often seeks refuge in history and visions from the past. This gives me great hope for the future of our planet. Now from the brief, there's a photo here under the title, The Battle for Ukraine's Internet, by Vera Bergengruen. Attempts to maintain online infrastructure, seen here in Kharkiv, have become critical in the ongoing war. This is a full-page photo accompanying the battle for Ukraine's internet and talking about infrastructure in Kharkiv. It's a man digging a ditch or a trench in which there are many, not hundreds, but dozens, cable lines. They're all black. Some are encased in tubing, which appears to possibly be concrete or a more flexible material, perhaps. The concrete, or the casing, at any rate, is broken up in places. Huge hunks of concrete have been upended and are at the top of the dirt spill from the trench that's being dug. This is all alongside what appears to be an older commercial building. It's probably cement block, kind of a grayish, whitish, mottled-looking paint job on the building. More buildings in the background, also one of those small semicircular tents which utility workers sometimes place over a manhole or another type of entry into the underground trenching system. In the wake of the counteroffensive that reclaimed vast swaths of Ukraine from Russian forces, teams of local technicians and engineers quietly arrived. Wearing helmets and bulletproof vests amid the ongoing shelling, often escorted by Ukrainian troops to avoid landmines, the workers barely waited to see the last of the retreating Russian soldiers before beginning to repair the damaged base stations and fiber optic cables that left hundreds of towns and villages cut off from the outside world. Ukraine's dogged efforts to restore internet and mobile connection underscore the urgency with which government officials view the communications blackout in previously occupied areas. The first thing the Russians do when they occupy these territories is cut off the network, says Stas Pribitko, head of mobile broadband development in Ukraine's Ministry of Digital Transformation. The people living there don't know what's happening in Ukraine. They cannot call family to describe the situation. They do not know whether their relatives are alive. The battle for control over Ukraine's internet shows how both sides view online access as a critical weapon in a 21st century war. After Russian troops invaded Ukraine in February, their occupation of Ukrainian towns followed a pattern. Upon establishing control, their first stop was often the offices of the local internet service provider, Ukrainian officials tell Time. There, the Russians often seized communications networks at gunpoint. More than 4,000 base stations belonging to Ukrainian telecommunications providers have been seized or destroyed by Russian soldiers since the beginning of the war, according to Ukraine's Special Communications Service. More than 60,000 kilometers of fiber optic lines used for the internet have been captured or damaged, and Russian forces destroyed 18 broadcasting antennas that provided television and radio signals. In some areas of southern Ukraine, Russia appears to have rerouted internet traffic through their own providers, exposing it to the Kremlin's vast system of surveillance and censorship. Since the invasion began, the number of users connecting to the internet in Ukraine has shrunk by at least 16%, according to London-based industry research group Top 10 VPN. Ukrainian telecom workers have been working just as hard to get the country back online. Mobile operators have rebuilt 71 of their base stations in areas liberated from Russian occupation since the beginning of the counteroffensive in September, according to figures shared with Time by Ukraine's digital ministry. In total, Ukrainian telecommunications workers have restored 1,232 base stations in areas occupied by the Russians since March. Before repairs are even completed, officials have been setting up makeshift Wi-Fi spots where locals stand in long lines to access the internet for 15 minutes apiece to avoid overwhelming, flimsy connections. This work has come at great risk to the technicians themselves. A vehicle carrying four employees of IRC Telecom, one of the country's leading service providers, recently drove over a landmine in the Sumy region, injuring three people and killing the driver. In Russian airstrikes October 10, some of which targeted telecommunications buildings, four employees of Ukraine's department overseeing digital infrastructure were killed. These restorations are being made with some really heroic efforts from these guys, says Pribitko. It's still very dangerous to do this work, but we cannot wait to do this because there are a lot of citizens in liberated villages who urgently need to connect. Pribitko's 11-person team in Ukraine's digital ministry are spending their days trying to navigate a patchwork of basic fixes to restore a connection to parts of the country and meeting with other government officials in a new working group set up to coordinate these efforts with local authorities and mobile providers. They have scrambled to make safety assessments, provide military escorts to areas that were occupied by Russian troops until recently, and find the necessary equipment in local warehouses. Many recently liberated areas are without power, requiring teams to run manual diesel generators. The biggest challenge has been ensuring the physical safety of the repair teams. In addition to the threat of bombardment, the mining of base stations is a big problem, Pribitko says, because the Russians have used landmines to avoid faster restoration of service. While the war continues, Ukrainian officials and internet providers say they've already won on the digital front. Rival carriers have worked together to provide roaming coverage for Ukrainian users who are able to jump from one network to another if their provider's coverage goes down. They have also collaborated to repair one another's bombed-out base stations. We really have brave technical teams and mobile operators, says Pribitko. They know the importance of what many people treated as trivial before. Make a phone call, browse the news. It is not a situation someone could imagine in the 21st century. Britain's newest leader faces a tough road. This is under the World heading by Yasmin Serhan. Britons have certainly heard this one before. After a period of tumult and uncertainty, the UK has a new Conservative Prime Minister. The Tory is Rishi Sunak, that's R-I-S-H-I-S-U-N-A-K, who entered 10 Downing Street less than 2 months after losing his first leadership bid to Liz Truss, who took over from Boris Johnson in September. Sunak's appointment may mark one of the swiftest political comebacks in British history. Sunak, who is of Indian origin, is the country's first prime minister of color. At the age of 42, he's also one of the youngest British leaders yet. And with a net worth of over $800 million, he's likely the first prime minister to be wealthier than even the royal family. The scale of challenges facing Britain obscures the historic nature of Sunak's premiership. His in-tray is filled with problems left over from his recent predecessors, including a cost-of-living crisis, rising energy costs, and soaring inflation. While Sunak's reputation for fiscal conservatism may work to calm financial markets and help balance the government's books, it will do little to comfort many Britons bracing for the return of austerity. That budget-tightening measures will be introduced by a millionaire may make them particularly hard for ordinary people to swallow. Aside from the steep economic challenges, Sunak will have to go about the difficult business of uniting his fractious party, which is polling at its lowest level since modern polling began. While Sunak claimed the support of the majority of conservative lawmakers, they can be a mutinous bunch. The fact that polls show the Tories facing obliteration at the next election, which is due to take place by January 2025, might keep rebellious MPs in line. That, of course, could all be moot if Sunak succumbs to intense public pressure to call a snap election long before then. The brief news business. Aid for chip makers. Cuts for workers. A small inset photo here of President Joe Biden behind a podium in the open air. I see an earth-moving piece of equipment in the background on what looks like leveled sandy tan ground, and a U.S. flag perhaps hanging from the crane of that earth mover or hanging from something else. When Intel and other semiconductor companies lobbied Congress to pass a $52 billion stimulus bill, one of the biggest federal investments in a private industry ever, they argued in part that the subsidies and tax breaks would protect American jobs. Yet just months after President Biden signed the CHIPS and Science Act in August, the nation's largest chip maker is reportedly planning to lay off thousands of employees amid declining demand for PC processors, according to Bloomberg. TSMC and Samsung are also looking to cut costs this year, but they could still be in line to get billions based on the promise of future jobs. Intel has committed $20 billion to build a chip-making megasite outside Columbus, Ohio. That was Intel. An Intel spokesperson declined to comment on the layoff report, but said the new facilities will create 3,000 jobs at the company. And experts say that even as demand for chips has waned in the face of a global economic slowdown, investing in the industry is likely to pay dividends for workers in the long run. And that was by Nick Popley. Good question. What is next in the fight over debt forgiveness? This is by Katie Riley. And there's a photo at the top in black and white. It's profiles of graduates. One sees the mortarboards on the tops of their heads. One is holding a handheld device up to her face. It's black and gray and white, and that's all there is to it, silhouettes in the dark. Cody Hunanian submitted his application for student loan forgiveness as soon as the site launched October 14. The executive director of the nonprofit Student Debt Crisis Center is himself among the 22 million borrowers who have already applied to receive up to $20,000 in debt relief under the Biden administration's program. It shows you how eager and in some cases desperate these borrowers are to get this relief, Hunanian says. But a week later, the program and any potential debt cancellation was put on hold as a federal appeals court considers one of several legal challenges brought against the program. Legal experts are skeptical that this case or the others will ultimately prevail in court and reverse the student loan forgiveness program, which could affect 40 million borrowers. The case now before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit was brought by six Republican-led states, which argue President Biden overstepped his authority and that the plan will cost them future tax revenue. The states appealed a decision by a district judge who dismissed the lawsuit for lack of legal standing, which requires a plaintiff to have suffered a concrete, imminent injury in order to bring a lawsuit. Student loan balances cannot be forgiven until there's a ruling from the appeals court. I think this is the case that's most likely to get the farthest of all the lawsuits that have been brought, says Tara Grove, a University of Texas School of Law professor. who focuses on the federal judiciary and separation of powers. And even this one, I think, is a stretch under current case law. No matter what happens with this case, more legal challenges are sure to follow, possibly halting the process again. There is widespread debate about the shaky legal justification for Biden's policy, but opponents of the plan have struggled to find someone with standing to sue over the program. And once borrowers begin receiving debt relief, it will become much harder to reverse, legal experts say. Meanwhile, the Education Department and advocates have encouraged borrowers to apply as soon as possible. "We are optimistic," Hunanian says. "We do not want borrowers spending their energy and worry on tracking a multitude of lawsuits that are already going out the door." This is Milestones launched. Nicole Mann, M-A-N-N, the first Native American woman in space. This is by Jeffrey Kluger. October 5, Nicole Mann, 45, blasted off for the International Space Station, becoming the first Native American woman in space. She gave her first interview to the Associated Press October 19 and spoke about the sense of awe astronauts experience looking down at Earth from space. "It is an incredible scene of color, of clouds and land," she said, "and it's difficult not to stay in the cupola all day and see our planet and how beautiful she is." That perspective is especially important as war continues to rage in Ukraine. The crew aboard the station includes 3 Russian cosmonauts, 3 American astronauts, and 1 astronaut from Japan. The power of such international collaboration is not lost on man. "What it does," she said, "is just highlight our diversity and how incredible it is when we come together as a species." And there's a photo at the bottom of this column, presumably Nicole Mann. It's a smiling face with bright brown eyes and bright teeth, wearing a spacesuit. And it does say N, Mann, below the patch of the American flag on her left sleeve. She's wearing a white uniform. The helmet looks like a visor that might come down fully over her face. What's interesting, this is a footnote that I should not be adding, but what is interesting is that as the first Native American woman in space, her clan or tribe was not mentioned. Split. Kanye West and Adidas. $1 billion deal terminated. The rapper and fashion designer Ye, also known as Kanye West, is no stranger to controversy. But when Adidas announced October 25 it was terminating its relationship with him, the move came amid mounting public pressure following several weeks of troubling statements that brought Ye beyond the familiar realm of the controversial. The German sportswear brand said it would cease selling and producing Yeezy-branded products and that the decision would deal a financial blow of 250 million euro, or $246 million, to its fourth quarter sales. West has attracted a wave of negative attention since debuting a White Lives Matter shirt at his Paris Fashion Week show in early October. The next week, in an interview on Tucker Carlson Tonight and in subsequently released footage, he made baseless claims about abortion and expressed anti-Semitic views. On a podcast, he spouted old tropes about the position of Jews in media and later tweeted he was going to go DEFCON 3 on Jewish people, leading his Twitter account to be locked. Demonstrators, October 22, held a sign over a Los Angeles freeway that read, "Kanye is right about the Jews," while giving a Nazi salute. Following all this, a slew of companies cut ties with West. He was dropped by his talent agency, CAA. A completed documentary about him was shelved by the studio MRC. Balenciaga, Gap, and Vogue forswore working with him. Adidas was the last of the major brands to announce the end of their relationship. Their work together was already strained, with Adidas placing the partnership under review earlier in October, and West responding that they raped and stole his designs. Many, including the Anti-Defamation League, called out the company, whose founders were members of the Nazi Party, for dragging its feet in ending an arrangement that meant $2 billion to the company last year. Yee's recent comments and actions have been unacceptable, hateful, and dangerous, Adidas finally announced, and they violate the company's values of diversity and inclusion, mutual respect, and fairness. And that article was written by Moises Mendez II. From the Milestones column, died Leslie Jordan, beloved comedy actor, best known for his role on Will and Grace, at 67, after a car crash October 24. Former Defense Secretary Ash Carter, who served in the position under President Obama at 68, October 24. Robbie Coltrane, the Scottish actor known for playing Hagrid in Harry Potter at 72, October 14. Appointed Chinese President Xi Jinping to a historic third term as head of the Chinese Communist Party, October 23, paving the way for him to rule for the next 5 years. Sentenced Donald Trump's longtime ally, Stephen Bannon, to 4 months in prison, October 21, for defying a subpoena from the House January 6 committee. Bannon, who cited executive privilege for his refusal to testify, remained free pending appeal. Charged two alleged Chinese intelligence officers with trying to interfere in the trial of a Chinese telecom giant, October 24, by the Justice Department. Fallen math scores in almost every state since before the pandemic, according to a national exam, the results of which were released October 24. Rejected WNBA star Brittany Griner's appeal of her drug smuggling conviction by a Russian court, October 25. Tech. Netflix charges for password sharing by Megan Mikoski. Netflix will soon start charging a fee for sharing an account with someone outside your household, the company said October 18. Users who've been borrowing credentials can either sign up for their own account, and Netflix will transfer viewing preferences, or the account holder can pay for a sub-account. The new rules begin in early 2023, and it is not yet clear how much the change will cost or how it will be enforced. Netflix first began experimenting with charging for password sharing in Costa Rica, Chile, and Peru earlier this year after the company lost subscribers for the first time in over a decade. It said last spring that cracking down on password sharing would be a big opportunity for revenue growth. This is Netflix's latest attempt to maintain the top spot in the streaming wars. The company said in its third quarter earnings report it had added 2.4 million subscribers, and it forecast a gain of 4.5 million subscribers as it rolls out a new, cheaper subscription plan, which will cost $6.99 in the U.S. The catch: you will be interrupted by an average of 5 minutes of ads per hour that will play before and during films and series. Netflix said it expects the new subscription with ads to be especially popular among those who have been sharing passwords. passwords. The brief news climate, the curious case of the cannibal crabs by Aaron Baker. There's a photo here in color. It's a body of water, blue, and there's some kind of a vessel stationary atop it. It looks maybe like a barge, but I don't know much about vessels on the water. And there's a cone-shaped cage that someone, it looks like a seaman, dressed in the orange water-repellent overalls and a heavy hoodie with black gloves. This seaman looks like he's hauling it aboard onto some slats on this barge or vessel or whatever it is stationed atop the water. Snow crab legs, the centerpiece of any self-respecting seafood platter, are no longer on the menu. They're the victim of a massive population crash that led Alaska to cancel its Bering Sea snow crab harvest for the first time in recorded history this year. The $132 million a year industry saw the state's snow crab population drop 87% from 8 billion in 2018 to 1 billion last year. Officials suggested climate change might be to blame. Alaska is the fastest warming state in the U.S., but that is only part of the story, says Wes Jones, an Alaska-based fisheries expert. According to the marine biologists he works with, the most immediate cause of snow crab death is something even seasoned fishermen did not see coming: a mass cannibalism frenzy. Back in 2017, Jones says, local crabbers started reporting a population explosion of juvenile snow crabs. The boom continued into 2019, creating what Jones says was the largest population on record. At the time, the young crabs were too small for a legal harvest. Juvenile snow crabs take 4 to 5 years to mature. Meanwhile, Bering Sea temperatures, which usually hover around freezing, were on the rise, spiking several degrees from 2017 to 2019, and causing the crustaceans to speed up their metabolisms. All of a sudden, you had this huge number of little crabs coming up, eating themselves out of house and home, says Jones. Then the water warmed, which meant they had to eat more. It was a double whammy, he says, and the results were inevitable for a hungry, omnivorous species that has run out of its usual food source. They basically cannibalized each other. Snow crabs are only the latest victims of climate change in the Bering Sea. Rising temperatures have often led to unpredictable boom and bust cycles, which have had unanticipated consequences up and down the food chain. A population explosion of sockeye salmon is one likely reason for the recent collapse of Alaska's red king crab harvest, which was canceled this year. Meanwhile, the warming waters of the Bering Sea have opened the door for Pacific cod, a predator of juvenile crabs. It will be years before the Alaskan snow crab population recovers to harvest-worthy levels, says Jones, and that's only if temperatures in the Bering Sea stay cool enough for the cold-loving juveniles, and climate change is making everything harder to predict. When you start seeing things outside the range of what you've seen before, says Jones, you do not know how that's going to affect something until it's happened, like rising water temperatures and cannibalism. The Risk Report by Ion Bremmer. This is a full page with a small inset photo of a well-dressed man in a blue suit, white shirt, and dark tie. He's walking across cobblestones in front of a columned marble, perhaps, building, whitish in the background, with rows of people standing in front of them, some holding the flags of France. The caption reads, Macron at a ceremony for Algerian war vets in Paris, October 18. This is not an easy time to lead a government. Right-wing challengers have taken power in Italy and Sweden. Brazil's Jair Bolsonaro will probably be defeated by a leftist former president. Rishi Sunak is Britain's third prime minister in 7 weeks. Joe Biden's Democrats are bracing for a tough election night. He writes next month. It's really now. All over the world, democracies face anti-incumbent anger. In France, meanwhile, President Emmanuel Macron had hoped to buck this trend. In April, he became the first chief executive to win re-election in his country in 20 years. Last year's retirement of German Chancellor Angela Merkel provided him an opportunity to act as Europe's lead statesman. His idea for a 44-nation European political community, which held its first meeting in October, is meant to give Europe a strategic unity and independence of action from Washington that Macron and many of his French predecessors have dreamed of for decades, even in the face of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Yet, once again, Macron finds himself bogged down with domestic political resentments. Right-wing parties point an accusatory finger at his globalist vision of France's future. Politicos and activists on the left say he's a king who cares nothing for the struggles of working people. The most recent confrontation comes from strikes called by the militant trade group Confédération Générale du Travail, CGT, the second largest of France's trade federations. The CGT has called a one-day strike, with more to follow in coming weeks across multiple economic sectors to protest the government's unwillingness to help the public cope with the country's high cost of living. The CGT is especially furious that the government used a constitutional maneuver to force striking oil refinery workers back on the job earlier in October. There's nothing new about French presidents and prime ministers faced with fist-shaking union members or with public support for their disruptions. Macron still carries political scars from his battles with the Gilets Jaunes, yellow vest protesters, during his first tenure. But France's troubles have only grown since then. In fact, the country now faces its worst energy crisis since the 1970s. Today, France draws nearly 70% of its electricity from aging nuclear power plants. At the moment, 26 of the country's 56 reactors are offline for maintenance, either routine or as a result of corrosion, leaving output at its lowest point since the 1990s. Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine made that problem worse when Macron led efforts in Europe to end the continent's dependence on energy exports from Russia. This summer, Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne warned French homes could face rolling blackouts at times this winter. Striking French workers then compounded the electricity problem further, with periodic strikes that have slowed repairs at 17 nuclear reactors. A cold, dark winter will not make Macron or Borne popular. But Macron's bigger fights with domestic rivals lie ahead. To strengthen his country's balance sheets without raising taxes and without a parliamentary majority to back him, France's ambitious 44-year-old president has signaled plans to move the full benefit retirement age for many workers from 62 to 64, beginning next spring, over a period of 4 years. If he is serious, and pension reform is so closely identified with his vision from France's future that it is hard to imagine he would drop it, he will have to resort to a hyper-controversial constitutional power called Article 49.3 that could allow him to push the plan through Parliament without a vote. If Macron and Borne take this path, Parliament may well vote no confidence in her government, forcing early elections that could leave Macron with a new prime minister who opposes his reform. His rivals mean for the current round of strikes to serve as a warning shot of bigger confrontations to come. Macron will have to proceed very carefully, and at a time when conditions in France and in Europe will only make his job more difficult. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. A photo here of a lot of feet on the floor. Some people attached to the feet are standing behind canvas like drapes, curtains. It's more than seven, the caption reads, more than 7 million votes had already been cast as of October 24. For most of any two-year election cycle, but especially as we get closer to election day, we are flying blind. Despite all the campaign ads and rehearsed speeches and faux scandals and, in some rare cases, actual in-person debates, we do not know which team's going to do better, and we do not like uncertainty. As in sports, we like to glance at a scoreboard to have a clear marker about whether the red team or the blue team is up. So in the interim, we turn to the political junkie's choice of drug choice, excuse me, the political junkie's drug of choice, polls. Now, I'm going to abbreviate this column considerably. And that is because by the time you hear this article read, it will have been election day. So, skipping ahead. This is the problem with polling right now. We treat it as gospel. Sometimes some of them are garbage. There's a reason the industry-wide standard of accuracy is only 95%, meaning one of every 20 results is simply a statistical outlier. Polls have consistently, with the exception of 2012, given Democrats too much of a leg up in recent cycles. Pollsters have missed on turnout by measures of 2 to 8 points. The Trump era contributed to a surge in voters refusing to engage with pollsters, resulting in bogus numbers. The pros are already anticipating garbage data in the stream, and fickle analysis has left confidence in the polls shaky at best and ruinous in reality. Still, most of the armchair political analysts look at the numbers as though they hold answers. Frank talk, they do not. They inform part of the discussion. They spot which campaigns might be toast. The polls can help decide whether a campaign should follow Twitter's advice and make social justice the hill to die on, or stick with the economy. Kitchen table issues like inflation and gas prices have dinged Democrats plenty hard, but it's also been a half century since abortion was as in play the way it is now. Polling provides some hints as to what is resonating and what is not, but no politician who wants to be seen as a leader defaults to what a pollster tells them. And that article was abridged. Here is the leadership brief by Belinda Luscombe, editor-at-large. This is a question-and-answer column. Let's see, we have 6 questions and answers. Will Johnson, CEO of the Harris Poll, calls the elections in 2016 a wake-up call for the polling industry. But he's an optimist, both about polling and about America. Question: we live in a highly politicized era. How is polling dealing with politicization of facts? Answer: in three places. Are you sure you're measuring the people you've set out to measure with your poll? Are you asking the question in a way that's balanced and getting at the essence? And then, as you are interpreting the statistics that come out of that result, are you able to provide a commentary that balances what you are able to glean and what it's not able to tell you? Question. People are becoming disenchanted with institutions, from media to schools. How is that reflected in your data? Answer. As everyone has access to more and more information across all those institutions, we've got a way more sophisticated consumer. But I like to go back to local institutions. Someone may say they don't like hospitals, but they love their local hospital. They love their doctor. It's way more nuanced and complicated, and I do not see the level of erosion seen by some of these places that maybe benefit from creating fear. Question. Have you noticed that people have become more distrustful of polls? Answer. I think 2016 and 2020, to some extent, was clearly a miss for the industry as far as understanding the electorate. It was a wake-up call. You cannot use the same techniques as things move faster. I push back on people who think that was inherent bias and nefarious. I think it was more about us having to be better at how we get to the voter. Question, can faith in political polls be restored? Answer, yeah, I think faith can be restored by getting it right. That's the neat thing about polling. The results are out there, and you can see how you did. That's number one. But number two is, what are you polling? The whole horse race dynamic of how we cover elections seems to be sending us down a less optimal path. Question. What are you doing differently? Why should people trust polls? Answer. The most important thing is making sure you're getting the right people. There are bots, and technology is changing so dramatically. We're reaching people online or on their phones, and you have to be vigilant. I have spent more time in the last 2 years talking to clients about who we are measuring than what we are measuring. It is no longer just a given. Question, what are the trends that make you feel optimistic? Answer, if you follow social media, you would think it's just two worlds completely divided. But when you talk to neighbors and go to places that may be different from yours, you see a great many values are similar. This next article may be abridged because of time constraints. It is six questions. Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, the physician and Pulitzer Prize-winning author, talks about cancer, COVID, and why we are not all bacteria. Siddhartha, the first name, Mukherjee, the last name, a photo here of this person. A man dressed in a black jacket, tie, and white shirt. That's all we see of him from the chest pocket upward. Fairly loose and long, but not straggly. Black hair, black facial hair, dark eyes, and smiling at the camera. As Walt Whitman wrote, we contain multitudes of cells. Do you see a poetry in cellular science? Answer, yes, I think it's tremendous. I think the idea of us being accumulations of cooperative units agglomerated into a whole is tremendously powerful. This article is by Jeffrey Kluger. Question, your childhood was not without its challenges. You have written candidly about a history of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder in your family. Did that shape your decision to study medicine? Answer, from the time I was a very young child, I was aware of suffering, and I think that influenced the way I thought about sickness. I began to think sickness is not something that's treated just by a doctor or team of doctors, but by a community that surrounds a person. For me to want to relieve your pain or your distress, whether by making a medicine or developing a science, is something both human and quite beautiful. Cancer, which you wrote about in The Emperor of All Maladies, is one disease that often defies our best medicines. The book almost conveys a certain grudging wonder at the malign genius of the cancer cell. What is it about cancer that makes it special? Answer. Cancer cells have this mechanism by which they can turn off immune system recognition. In the 2000s, everyone was talking about how if we sequence the genome of cancer, you would find all the keys, and that
all that we would need to do would be to find the locks, but we still do not have a very good pharmacopoeia of drugs to direct against cancer mutations. So I can tell a patient, you have a mutation in XYZ gene. And then the patient says, okay, what are you going to do about it? And I say, I don't know. I don't have anything to do about it. Your new book, The Song of the Cell, seems at points to anthropomorphize cells. You write about the subtle intelligence of cells, or about the T cell as a discerning cell. Don't you run the risk of overestimating the complexity of the cell? Answer, it does sound as if cells have agency, but it's not the agency you and I have. Cells behave autonomously. They receive signals. They integrate signals. They have a desire to survive. They have a desire to divide. So I'm not concerned about the idea of ascribing agency to a cell, as long as we do not confuse that agency with sentience. You write about the COVID-19 pandemic as something of a humbling experience for scientists. Yet we have fought back, we've developed vaccines, we've reopened the world. So how have we been humbled? Answer, we thought we knew everything about the immune system and viruses, and still there have been 6 million deaths. I think from global health systems all the way down to allergies and immunology, there are some fundamental features we still do not understand, and we have not been paying attention to them. It took a pandemic to make us wake up and say, you know what, this is serious stuff. So yeah, I think there's been some humbling. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.